Hello and welcome to this discussion about the Electoral College. It's something that comes up every 4 years, but really is something that probably deserves a little more attention frequently, more frequently than that. Today we have three wonderful panelists. All the way down at the end of the table is Jeff Melanson from the Department of History. Next to him, James Toole from the Department of Political Science. And then next to him, Mike Wolf, chair and professor in the Department of Political Science. Today's event is brought to you by, of course, the Honor Center. We like to thank them for letting us use this space and providing you with a little something to eat while you're here. The folks at College Television for recording it, and then not only College Television, but WBOI for making it available to people. We like to thank the library because they also store these discussions for us in their electronic database, and we will waste no time and get right into it. Mike, what exactly is the Electoral College?
The Electoral College is the constitutionally created entity for the choice of the President of the United States. And each state is given a number of electors equivalent to the number of representatives and senators that it has. And its design, while controversial both in our present creation and in the past, the idea was, in a sense, and I'll let Jeff talk about it more, about the need to have an entity there and the reasons why an entity would need to reflect the views of the citizens of a state. And so the Electoral College is in effect when it meets both in the state capitals and then in Washington, D.C., or the nation's capital at the time of the Constitution, is the mechanism then to the actual direct election of the President of the United States.
Jeff, I like talking to Jeff about these sorts of things because he knows the era well and quite often dispels the mysticism and myths of the time period. So, Jeff, give us a dose of reality. What were the founding fathers thinking when they created the college?
They were thinking they couldn't come up with anything that everyone would agree to. The Constitutional Convention met from May of 1787 to September of 1787. Anytime the presidency came up, they started talking about how they should elect or appoint or select the president, and they just couldn't come into an agreement on what that process should look like. In one day of debate in August, they literally put out their six different possibilities and voted them all down because they couldn't figure out what it would look like. Finally, the question was so irresolvable, they formed a special committee toward the end of the convention where they basically just said, hey, solve the problems we can't solve as a full convention. They put a committee of each one member from each state. They put them in a room together and said, fix the problems. And this was the main question they were actually organized to answer. And the solution they came up with was the Electoral College. It was loosely based on the system Maryland had in place for electing their state senators. And the idea was it was a balance of state interest, popular interest. They didn't think the people could directly elect the president. They didn't want the states to be selecting the president. They didn't want the legislature to be electing the president. And so this kind of was a way of giving some power to various different parts, allowing different parts of the system to express their viewpoints and to have an election that wouldn't make the president beholden. This was another important concern. It wouldn't make the president beholden to the people at large. It wouldn't make the president beholden to Congress, which they were especially worried about, but allowed all the different parts to potentially play a role. One other thing I'll emphasize in terms of what the founders were thinking when they created it. Their expectation was that more often than not, it would ultimately be Congress that would make the decision. So the electors vote. You have to get a majority of votes in the Electoral College to be elected as president. And it's clear if you actually read the debate they had after the committee issued its report proposing the Electoral College, that the expectation was that more often than not, the electors would not pick someone. And so it became really important to figure out, well, then how do we, from all the people the electors vote for, how do we figure out who gets to go on in the process, and then how do we figure out who's going to select the process? At first, that committee recommended that it be the Senate that choose. And there was a real concern that that would give the Senate way too much power, that the Senate would approve the president, but then the president was the person making all these appointments that then had to go to the Senate for approval. And so there'd be too much of a, well, if I want to be president and I want the Senate to do what I say, I have to be really nice to senators, and it creates some conflicts. And so This is where they came up with the idea of, well, let's send it to the House of Representatives. But if we send it to the House of Representatives, Virginia and Pennsylvania could potentially just elect a president every time because of how many representatives they'll have. So let's have the House then vote by state. And so it's such a convoluted system to address all of the particular concerns that the people in the room had about how the system might be abused and who would owe duties, to, owe favors to who and whatever else. So.
I actually want to ask for at least one of the ones that was voted down. But before we do, let's stick to the way it works right now. Mike, Jamie, Jeff, I don't care who, would someone please explain what happens if no one actually gets to the number of electors, majority of electors, whoever wishes to answer. Mike,
go ahead. Since it did that, it would go to the House of Representatives.
And so it's simple majority, but the state votes as a state. So
yes.
Indiana has one vote in this case. Mm-hmm. And then who becomes the vice president?
It's chosen by the Senate.
In that instance, each senator has a vote, correct? So in that instance, we have, the possibility exists that you could end up with a person from one party and a person from another party as president and vice president. So mm-hmm. It is convoluted, to say the least. But Jeff, in the interest of making sure everybody has at least one good trivial piece of knowledge in their head today, tell us one version that was voted down.
They proposed direct election by the people. And that got voted down. They proposed having it be elected by the Senate alone. That got voted down. They proposed having Congress as a whole vote, which also got voted down, because if you do it by joint ballot, as they debated, that just means the House gets to pick every time because the House will have more people than the Senate. So there are three ones that they voted down.
Excellent. Thank you. Now, was the college actually a good idea? I mean, was this a good compromise? Well, go ahead and start with Jeff. Was this a good compromise? At the time.
It's really fascinating because in Federalist, I want to say it's Federalist 68. Let me double check. I've got it right here. Federalist 68, Hamilton writes about the Electoral College and makes the point. This is the opening lines of it. The mode of appointment of the Chief Magistrate of the United States is almost the only part of the system of any consequence which has escaped without severe censure or which has received the slightest mark of approbation from its opponents. So basically saying, no one's complaining about it, and even the people who don't like the Constitution don't have much to say about it. Basically saying, at the time, everyone thought, oh, this is a good system. Hamilton actually says, I venture somewhat further and hesitate not to affirm that if the manner of it be not perfect, it is at least excellent. So they were very proud of it. They thought this was a really strong, important part of their system. And I actually think, given the different competing concerns they had, it made a degree of sense at the time. Because it was essentially, the fundamental purpose of the college was we're going to elect this group of knowledgeable, educated people to choose our president for us. Hamilton in Federalist 68 argues that the quality of these people who would be making this decision is really important because they'd be capable of figuring out who would best represent the country. But the other argument Hamilton made is that if you let a state legislature, you let the national legislature elect the president, those are standing bodies that are subject to corrupting influences. Foreign governments could come in and try and bribe congressmen. But if you specially elect these electors in each of the states to choose the president, it makes it much harder to corrupt the process. So at the time, given their various competing concerns, it actually was a reasonable system. And it remained a reasonable system for about a year and a half.
A good long time.
Yes.
But now I have to ask, do you think this was them rationalizing the choice they made, or did they really think it was a good idea?
Well, the Federalist papers were propagandistic more than anything else. They were trying to sell the Constitution to the people of New York. So to a certain extent, I think Hamilton was really just trying to pump up this idea. But by that point, there had been more than enough popular discussion of the Constitution that when he says people aren't complaining about this, at least, I mean, that part is true. I think they could all agree that it was a worthwhile way of solving this conundrum.
Jamie or Mike, do you agree mm-hmm. they actually believed it was a good idea, Jamie?
Well, I was going to talk more about sort of your original question about whether it was good for its time. And what I would say is, there are two, I think, big features of this. One, that it was somewhat messy in its development, complex, vague, subject of a lot of debates. And second, that the process created was indirect. And I think both of those things, and indirect in the sense that, of course, the people aren't directing the electing the president, but the people are directing people who then elect the president. And I think neither of these things should be surprising given the historical moment. And I think if we put this into broadest perspective, what we see is a very new country. trying something that had rarely been tried before. I mean, there were representative bodies in some select other countries in the world, et cetera, but the idea of doing this without a monarch was really, you know, quite revolutionary. Only 2 years after this, the French Revolution comes along, in which the monarchy in France is destroyed. So this is the very beginning of a very important period in world history, in which we start moving away from the idea that a monarch should be deciding things. And so we're trying to figure out what that new replacement would be, and we're trying to figure out how to select the person to rule us. Allied with that is this idea that this is that the process, you know, set upon in the end is an indirect one. I mean, there was a lot of skepticism, and I think understandable for the time, about the idea that the people could actually rule themselves. I mean, most people didn't have, you know, weren't beneficiaries of mass formal education, and simply it just hadn't been tried before. And elites all around the world, I mean, we didn't have an aristocracy in this country at that point, but all around the world, elites could not believe that it would ever possibly be a good idea to have ordinary people selecting their leaders. So I think for the time, in broad historical perspective, and indeed in global perspective, we can understand both the development of this being kind of complex and uncertain, and also the outcome hitting upon a process that was indirectly selecting the leader rather than trusting the people to directly select the leader.
In addition to the lack of education, there also was a lack of communication that made a real sort of campaign the way we think of them today, or the dissemination of information, not really possible. Mike?
Yeah, that's what I was going to add, that, you know, it was impossible to kind of reach broadly to inform somebody. And also people's frame of reference was, because constitutionally before that, was very connected to their state. There was an inability to understand who would have been a political elite that would have been worthwhile to vote for outside and without newspapers, when you can't read a newspaper, and broad circulation, the ability to pass information to a voter to really have them educated would have been very extremely difficult. And so we would end up, as Jeff said, the big states would have just, if it was under popular election, they have a very distillated choice, and Virginia would have won, which they sort of almost did anyway a lot of times. But.
All right, so we started with all of you saying yes for the time period made sense, and then Jeff, during his comment, said it made sense for about a minute and a half, or maybe it was a year and a half, he said it made sense. There must have been some recognition of the limitations at the time period. Was there recognition of that at the time? Did people actually say, okay, here is how the process is sort of limited? Or was it really more just a celebration of, hey, we came up with an idea, let's do it?
There wasn't much discussion. There was so much concern about the presidency itself, the concern that the president could become a monarch, the president could lead the country to tyranny, that there wasn't a ton of debate about the merits of the particular system of choosing him, especially when you're able to explain, we made this decision to address this concern, and we made this decision to address this concern. I mean, note that in Federalist 68, Hamilton doesn't say, well, we wanted to use the Electoral College because we don't trust the people to make the decision. I mean, they couldn't be blatant about it in that regard. But so they can, when you kind of don't frame it in the negative terms, there's a lot of positive reasons why this system is preferable to other systems. And so you can sell it to a people who've never considered how this would even work in the first place. I mean, we have our perspective on this is ingrained in 200 plus years of how the process works, but for these people, this was new. This was the first time this has been done, so they didn't have that frame of reference.
Mm-hmm. But would somebody have thought about the limitations? I mean, clearly there must have been some recognition of that.
The biggest limitation of the Electoral College is one that wasn't, and this is why I said it worked for a year and a half, was one that the biggest limitation about it was political parties. And they didn't have political parties in 1787, 1788, 1789. But political parties at the second presidential election fundamentally altered the way the Electoral College worked, because political parties started organizing ahead of time how the electors would coordinate their efforts and vote for certain people. This was not anticipated in the Constitutional Convention. And this is potentially one of the dangers of them, like 11 guys sitting in a room being like, all right, that's what we're going to do. And then the next day, them all saying, yay, let's do this. And then all of a sudden, it's the Constitution. I mean, this wasn't well thought out, lengthily debated. Let's really seriously consider all the ramifications here. It was kind of like, oh, this works, I guess. Yeah, okay, let's change this. All right, we're done. And so they didn't really think about the negative ramifications. And there was, like I said, there were so many other problems with the Constitution I don't think anyone spent much time really seriously debating how this could go wrong. But then as soon as political parties start forming, it goes really wrong. I mean, they start proposing lots of different methods of amending the Constitution to get rid of the Electoral College in 1797.
So there was no way. I mean, we pretty much recognized the problem very quickly and said, let's change
we had,
it.
Washington got elected twice. They had the election in 1796 between Adams and Jefferson, where they became president and vice president of competing political parties. And at that point, they started saying, yeah, this doesn't work the way we want it to. And then in 1800, they tie. Jefferson and his vice presidential candidate, Aaron Burr, tie. And at that point, they say, okay, we can't do this anymore. And they amend the Constitution to fundamentally change how it works.
The constitutional system, I mean, there's a lot of discussion of how carefully planned out this was, which is at odds with what Jeff is saying, because there's a lot of people that invested in this. But it is the case that this was an incrementally running situation. And even if it were well planned, you still have a situation where if you have a federal constitution with a singular federal office that it has, then giving states who are sovereign over elections. So there is no fix constitutionally unless the federal government were to take over this electoral process, which it didn't want to do and states probably wouldn't have allowed it. So the kind of missing piece here is something that wouldn't have been acceptable probably at the time constitutionally to bring about an answer.
So even though there's recognition of the problem, there's no solution, no readily identifiable solution to this.
If they thought it was a problem.
If they thought it was a problem, yeah. Sure. Jamie, are there countries that have used a similar approach or are currently using a similar approach?
Well, this is a really interesting question, and the short answer is no. But let me give you a little more.
But it's interesting still. That's good.
Trust me, it's more interesting than that. So let me give you some perspective. We're now jumping ahead to today's world, right? And we see. By the way, the data I'm about to give you come from the ACE Electoral Knowledge Network, which is a really good website. If you're interested in this stuff, you can play around with the data, see how elections run in different countries. It's a project of the International Foundation on Electoral Systems, the Institute for Democracy and Electoral Assistance, and some other prominent NGOs who work in this stuff. So again, that's the ACE Electoral Knowledge Network, a great database and source of information. So first of all, of the 236 countries and territories that are covered in this database, and I'll just briefly note that I would have preferred them just to have been countries because it complicates things to throw in territories, but this is the best available data, so we use that. Out of 236 countries and territories, 70% have presidents. That's the first thing to say. The others generally have monarchs, constitutional or non-constitutional, monarchs who do not have to or are not constrained by constitutionality. So 70% of countries have presidents, but it's important to note that of those presidents, only 35% of them serve as both head of state and head of government, which is the situation we have in this country. And I think we need to pause for a minute and take a look at what this means. In any country, there is a head of state function and a head of government function. Americans might see this most clearly in Britain, where there is Queen Elizabeth, who is the head of state, and, of course, the prime minister, who is at this moment Theresa May. And in a parliamentary democracy like Britain's, the prime minister is the head of government and has all of the political power. I mean, the queen these days has only ceremonial functions. But still the queen exists and is valued as the head of state because she is seen to embody the country as a whole in a very nonpartisan and non-divisive way. It's a source of unity to be a head of state. To be a head of government is something very different. It's to be partisan and not for the sake of being partisan, but it's for the sake of governing, for moving the country ahead in your chosen direction. And so we expect heads of government to be the ones with the power, to be the ones who can act, who can move the country forward. And we expect them also to have particular points of view and indeed to be opposed in a democratic system by an opposition that would at some point hope to retake that head of government position. So in the United States, what we do is we fuse those two together in the office of president. So our president is head of state and head of government. So on a daily basis, what we normally see is the president as head of government, sort of proposing things that he wants, arguing perhaps with the opposition, whatever. But at times, we see the president as head of state. When a foreign leader comes for a state dinner, for example, at the White House, the president hosts. There will be leaders of the Democratic Party, the Republican Party, all parties, you know, both parties represented, people from across the spectrum, celebrities will be there, you know, whatever. And the idea is that we are welcoming this head of state to us as a full country, as a unified country. Now, I go into all of this diversion to emphasize that that's sort of the appropriate group of countries with whom we should compare the United States now. And so not only is the United States the only country in the world with an electoral college, it is also the only country among those 58 countries. These are the ones that have one person as head of state and head of government combined. The only one of those 58 countries that uses an electoral college. A brief note, of those countries that have a president as both head of state and head of government, 75% of them directly elect the president. So that's the norm in countries with sort of, you know, powerful presidencies like ours. 74% actually directly elect the president. A further 16% indirectly elect the president using the legislature. So that's a very interesting and unusual thing. The most prominent of these countries is South Africa. So in South Africa, the president is both head of state and head of government, but is elected by the South African parliament. So that's very much indirect election, I would say more so than our electoral colleges, because our electoral college usually does, to a pretty good degree, mirror the popular vote. But that's not necessarily the case when you have a legislature elect the president. So it's notable then, in conclusion, that of the 236 countries and territories, the United States is the only one that has an electoral college. So this is not a feature of our constitutional system that anybody else has deemed one worth adopting in their own country.
In a moment, you're all going to get to tell everyone the challenges, limitations to our current system, but why haven't other countries mimicked this? I mean, so much of what we have done here from a mm-hmm. governing standpoint has been viewed as a good approach.
Right.
Why has this been viewed?
Well, I think I'll leave the main part of the answer to our ensuing discussion of strengths and weaknesses of the Electoral College. So I guess my main argument would be that there are plenty of weaknesses that other countries have recognized. But apart from that, let me just say that this is, of course, a product of our own historical development. So as a very old democracy in comparative perspective, you know, we were one of the first to develop this, subject to all the sort of complications that Jeff has talked about. You know, there are of course great challenges in innovating and being a pioneer. So, you know, we came up with this system that grew out in part, of course, as Mike suggested, it grew out very much from the idea that these were states that viewed themselves as sovereign that were coming together in sort of an uneasy and originally very loose confederation that later became stronger under the Constitution. But it's a pattern that you don't see replicated really elsewhere in the world in the same way. So one answer is because this system has a lot of weaknesses that other countries don't want to replicate. And the second is, I think, it's a product of our own sort of unusually long-term and special historical pattern of development.
Well, Mike, go ahead and get us started. The limitations of the system that you see today?
They're numerous. One, you can obviously have a loser be the winner. And that is a problem for a democracy, a representative democracy as well, that you can end up, you know, having someone with more votes end up not being the winner, I think clearly is. And other big points that get raised are almost in opposition to some of those raised about what the benefits of the Electoral College. So those, the proponents of the Electoral College, say it kind of protects republicanism and it protects federalism. Because it provides equality then to some of the states. And certainly regionalism was probably much more, as we've been discussing, a big issue at the time of the framing. But in reality, the arguments are that equality really isn't really based on states now as they used to be. It's within states. Inequality, whether it's racial, gender, economic, and other issues, the meaning of equality has shifted. So the argument is, while this might have been an important kind of component for why people thought this would have been a good plan to provide for equality across the states, in fact, now it perverts the idea of what an election should be trying to provide as far as what equality actually does. I'll let Jamie talk about one person, one vote. I know he's itching to do it. But the other components that really stand out is, as some people say, well, this protects the two-party system. But as Jeff said, this wasn't designed to do that. So this defense of that, and if anything, I think that's a bogus argument. I think this, in fact, our electoral system being a plurality system, encourages two parties and would encourage this even further with a national election, as it turns out. And the other component is that that we don't often think about that is raised is that our current system takes individuals' votes who have voted for the loser and makes them into a winner's vote. And we don't tend to think about this, but for those people in Indiana or somewhere else that voted for Hillary Clinton, your vote was taken and created to vote for Donald Trump. And those that people voted for Donald Trump in California, now, no, that's not your vote. Your vote is for Hillary Clinton. So the argument is in the indirect way we do this, we're also kind of taking people's vote and their preference away from them and making this into something that it was not meant to be. And the other argument about the fact that we've chosen particular states that are competitive states, we're only campaigning. This is not a national election. We're not choosing a president for that. We're choosing a president in some states that are showdown states, and that's it. And those states are oftentimes not reflective of the whole United States. The fact that California, Illinois, New York, and Texas get completely ignored in a presidential election, and the only state that is one of the top five big states is Florida, and they get over attended to, is a perverse thing. I mean, I don't think you can take 40% of the American population and take them off the board immediately, and that's just those five states. Forget other states like Indiana, et cetera.
But let's remember, part of that is also about campaigning. I mean, if you are campaigning and you're trying to win a direct election, you simply go where there are people, as opposed to where there are electors. So, I mean, the idea that if the college were gone, suddenly every state would see the same amount of campaigning is false. I mean, we Indiana may still not see almost any campaigning.
And that's the critics, the protection, those that say the Electoral College, we would ignore rural states and we ignored kind of other places. Well, many of them are getting ignored right now. It's not like anyone spent any time in Wyoming and et cetera. And also, why is that preferable to people not going to L.A. or New York City or something? I don't know, you know, the trade-off there, the perception, we don't lose anything by in effect changing. It's just the winners and losers change.
Mm-hmm. Jamie, we'll come to one person, one vote in a moment. Jeff? Other limitations you see today?
I would point to two things. One is, I think, a legitimate limitation, and the other is a limitation I see as a historian, so no one is going to care about. First, I think the vast majority of people don't actually understand what it is they're doing on Election Day, and I think that's a huge problem. That on Election Day, you're not voting for Hillary Clinton or Donald Trump. You're not voting for president. You're voting for a group of people who will then go and make the decision to vote for president. You're voting for the Electoral College. And I think the fact that people don't understand the way the system actually works, the fact that people think, I'm going to vote for Hillary Clinton or I'm going to vote for Donald Trump because I want to make that person president, it's like, well, you don't have a choice. You get to vote for a set of electors who are appointed by your party in most cases, and then the party gets to dictate how those people behave.
I do want to point out, in terms of historical elements, if people will go back and look at old election results, what you actually will see is the slate of electors. You do not see the president and vice presidential names. You'll see the names of the people who were being elected electors. And I know I found an example here in Allen County where if you look at the slate, actually there was one person who did not get the same number of votes as everyone else. So there were voters who were consciously saying, yes, I like these people, but not this one.
Well, this is the reason I have I see a limitation in the college in terms of, as a historian, it's that the original purpose of the college was that we're going to select the people we are most trust, we think are most trusted to make this decision about who our president is going to be. And we are going to empower these people to make an independent decision. I have no idea how Jamie's going to vote if I elect him as an elector, but I trust Jamie's judgment, and so I want him making this decision about who the president should be. Or I don't trust Mike at all. I think he'd make a terrible decision. I don't know who he's going to vote for, but I don't trust his judgment, and so I'm definitely not going to vote for him to be an elector. Sorry, guys.
No, you complimented me.
Well, yeah, so, yeah. But we've completely done away with that. These electors are basically just automatons at this point. That the party picks them, and then the popular vote in the state determines who they're gonna vote for. And in half the states, there are actual laws saying they're not allowed to exercise independent judgment. They're legally bound to vote for whoever the popular vote winner in the state was, whoever their party's nominee was. There's legal questions about whether or not those laws would stand up to judicial scrutiny if they're ever challenged. But if the college was created to do one specific thing, and it now exists to do something that has nothing at all to do with that one specific thing it was created to do, I just think there's no rational reason to keep it in place. I know after the election, and when this came up to be a subject of debate, we should get rid of the Electoral College, people started throwing around all sorts of rationales. Oh, no, the founders wanted it to protect republicanism. The founders wanted it to protect the agrarian regions. The founders wanted it to do this, that, and the other. And it's like, the founders were thinking about none of that stuff. All of this is just retroactive rationalization for why this is an important system. The founders wanted a group of people to make an independent decision. And essentially in 1804, we got rid of that ability for them to do that. And ever since then, it's just been a partisan system designed to ensure that the parties get what they want.
And see, this is why I like Jeff to help dispel the myth of the founding fathers and what they were thinking about. Jamie, one person, one vote?
So I would say that the first way to look at this is that this is, of course, as we've all said, an indirect system of election. And personally, I find that offensive. I mean, in the modern age, that citizens are, strictly speaking, by the letter of law, not trusted to vote for president. So I simply find it repulsive that we as citizens are not allowed to directly express our preferences that are then tabulated into a vote. No, we somehow still have to be channeled through other people. So just on moral principle, I find that to be a severe problem. Second problem is that this, and these are all related to one person, one vote. Second problem is that this system fundamentally is, of course, based on states. It's also based on people. You know, more populous states have more electoral votes. But fundamentally, the system is structured around states. And I think that while that was important early in our republic, because, of course, you know, these states were coming together voluntarily and their interests had to be taken deeply into account, the world has changed, and this country has changed tremendously since then. And I think states are less important than they were back then. But more important than that, I don't think that our electoral system should be based on states. A democracy is a system in which the people rule, not a system in which the states rule. We are a country of people, not a country of states. Or at least we are much more a country of people than we are a country of states when you think about what democracy should mean. So the idea that we're actually structuring a system around states in a way that corrupts the principle of all votes being equal, one person, one vote, I find to be deeply problematic on moral grounds. So if we then get to the specific question of one person, one vote, we see that the Electoral College is, in fact, unequal. Not radically so, but it is to some degree, and it privileges smaller states and at the expense of larger ones. And, again, if you believe that democracy is about representing people, not states, and you believe that democracy is a system based fundamentally on equality, then this is then there is no reason whatsoever that we should have a presidential election system that actively discriminates against people in larger states and actively discriminates in favor of people in smaller states.
Do the math quickly for those who don't understand the small state advantage here.
Right. So the number of electors from a particular state is, of course, the number of members of Congress plus the numbers of senators you have. Every state has the same number of senators. So that's where the inequality comes in, because generally speaking, the 435 congressional districts are based on roughly equal population sizes. But, you know, if you're from one, so from a small state, you get two added electors even though your population may only be, you know, under a million people. And if you're a large state, say California, you still only get two more electors, even though your population is, what, 35, 38 million, something like that.
So even though California has many more electors in the college, when you start looking at it on a per capita basis,
that's right.
Wyoming actually ends up with a little more oomph. So
that's right. It's not that.
Yeah, four times.
Right. As much.
Yeah. So no. It ends up being a significant amount. It is, by the way, not nearly as disproportionate as our U.S. Senate. And if we feel like getting into that, we can get into that. That is grossly disproportionate in terms of one person, one vote. But I'll leave that aside.
This is only modestly
disproportionate, but still, it's the exact same reason. It's just a different magnitude.
And then also, you know, one additional thing we don't think about that is less kind of directly connected to the working of, it's a disincentive to vote. I mean, you know, we have lower voter turnout in states that are going to be determined that don't, the competition isn't in. If you look at the undervote for Hillary Clinton this year, whether you care or not, her undervote was in California, Vermont, all these stable Democratic states that had no competition anywhere else. And so, you know, some states that are off the board early on, the people decide not to turn out to vote. So it's also a disincentive for one of the core parts of. And then local elections, which are important to some people, get affected as well because you don't have the turnout there to generate a competition out up and down the ballot. So
Jeff?
I just want to build on something Jamie said about the people in the, you know, the people in the states. Does the government, do we, you know, are we a country of people or a country of states? The answer to that question has not been consistent throughout our history. When we started, the states mattered much more, and so a system like the Electoral College was designed to represent the interests of both the people and the states. The country has evolved significantly since 1787, and I think the Electoral College is no longer a good representation of what we believe in as a country.
Yeah, I think it's safe to say that when all of us, when we're talking with students, especially in sort of the 100-level classes, and we bring up, for example, are you a citizen? Jamie loves this. A citizen of what? Jamie will say, you're a citizen of the United States. And I will quickly point out, no, you're a citizen of Indiana and of the United States. And then we get into a debate that he and I have been having for a long time about whether state and local politics really matters or whether it's all about international stuff. But that's a little debate between the two of us that we've had going on for a while. We do actually view these things very differently, though. I mean, people today, the borders between states are, they're non-existent for many people. Their existence is as a person who lives in the United States. Now, the direct vote is obviously the one, popular vote is one that comes up quite often as an alternative. But before we get there, I want to throw a couple of defenses of the college at you, and then you tell me whether they're adequate defenses or not. For example, some would argue that if we simply didn't do the winner-take-all strategy, if we actually did, for example, what Maine does, then we would have something that deals with the competition issue because suddenly congressional districts matter a little bit more. Is that a way to begin addressing at least some of the limitations of the Electoral College? Mike, we'll start with you since you...
There are fixes within this constitutional system, and it's unlikely we would see these small states, which would be needed to address a constitutional change, much less having a national election, which we constitutionally can't have right now. The complications would be many, but there are ways to, as Nebraska and Maine do, split up by districts. There are arguments that this is what a lot of the founders wanted us to kind of replicate anyway and to do. And increasingly and importantly, and we can come back to this later, the biggest thing we could do to offset this is to increase the size of the House of Representatives, as it should have been done for the last 100 years, and we've ignored doing. And if we had done so, which was a real preference of the founders to keep population reflected in the House of Representatives, we would then have an electoral college that would have much more number of people, and those are the offset, the four times, as I said, power that Wyomings have over Californians would be brought down. It would never be brought down to 1-to-1. I mean, we're not going to get one person, one vote, but the offset would be tremendously much more if we went to the district system and then made those districts make sense. We had the Electoral College is way too out of whack right now, and so is the House of Representatives.
Now, Jeff, with this, obviously, at this moment, this gets closer to, or at least allows to some degree, for people to be thinking to a degree about who the actual electors are. Not that it really works out quite that way, but, you know, it's no longer one winner-take-all kind of scenario. And so, you know, there's a little more competition.
But I guess my question would be, what's the problem you're trying to solve with that solution? And so, if the goal is to get to a system that's more representative of the popular sentiment, why go through all of that and not just do a popular vote? Now, the main defense of what would be the best legitimate defense of the Electoral College today is the majority principle. You have to get a majority of the vote to win. And so, 1992, Bill Clinton wins the presidency with 43% of the popular vote. 1860, Abraham Lincoln wins the presidency with 40% of the popular vote, a very current example of the presidential election in process. But they still have a mandate to rule because they got a majority of the electoral vote. And so on that majority principle, that's the most significant drawback of moving over to the strict popular vote, is that you don't have this majority principle anymore. But I'm not sure that, you know, so maybe the district method becomes a way of preserving the majority principle in some way, but still giving the local elections a bit more control. But what happens if by moving over to this district method, you end up actually making it harder for someone to get a majority? And you end up with more frequently third parties running, and you end up with more elections not resulting in a clear winner from the Electoral College, and then you're going to end up with the House of Representatives choosing our president for us. And so let's envision the scenario where Donald Trump doesn't win the Electoral College, Hillary Clinton doesn't win the Electoral College, or Hillary Clinton gets more popular votes, though, is wanted by more Americans to be the president, and then you have a Republican-controlled House of Representatives. They're not going to elect Hillary as president. They're going to elect Donald Trump as president. And the House is and the Democrats would have done the same thing if the situation, it's not disparaging Republicans. And so, I mean, fundamentally, I don't think there's a solution within the Electoral College that doesn't create new unintended consequences that actually gets to the main problem we're trying to address. Like, it seems like the district thing, it's like, yay, we should do this so we can preserve the Electoral College. But why do we want to preserve the Electoral College?
All right, well, Jamie, how about this one? Yeah. If instead of voting for Donald Trump or Hillary Clinton, we actually saw the list of electors and we actually had to understand who they were, would that actually get us closer to what the Founding Fathers were looking for? And would it actually get us to a position where informed, very well-informed individuals were making a selection as opposed to those who mm-hmm. may have just fallen for the prettiest commercial, mm-hmm. so to speak?
Yeah. Well, I don't...
And it shortens the campaign, too,
yeah.
doesn't it?
So, no, I don't think that helps at all. And I think one main reason it doesn't is that we already know that people vote on relatively little information already. I mean, the idea of learning about your electors in addition to learning about the people for whom they might be voting for president seems like a stretch too far for many, many people. We already have low voter turnout. Do we really want to put yet another hurdle in front of people in terms of learning about how their system works? So I doubt very much. And I do think, I mean, I've already expressed strong disagreement with the Electoral College. I think all of these are just tinkering around the edges. These are fundamental problems that cannot be overcome within the structure of the Electoral College system. Let me mention two things. Number one, it's true, as Mike said, there's no way that this is going to be fundamentally changed anytime soon, which would, you know, require changes in the Constitution. What really matters, I think, is that we have this conversation. We haven't been talking about this, and we need to really start talking about this as a matter of American political institutions, not because you liked Hillary Clinton and you're annoyed that Donald Trump won the Electoral College but didn't win the popular vote. No, but because we care about our institutions and we want to make them better. So just having the conversation means that maybe 20 years down the line or 30 years down the line, there actually will be the momentum needed to actually change this in a fundamental way, not in a tinkering way. And the second thing I would say is I agree with Jeff that it would be really attractive to have a system that created majorities. And that is, you know, one of the arguments in favor of the Electoral College, that it can do that. Again, it can only do it in a partial and, I think, very flawed way. But it's very easy to create a built-in majority for a president, and that's using a two-round majoritarian electoral system with a popular vote. This sounds more complicated to explain than it really is. France uses this. And so what happens is that there are two rounds of a presidential election. And in the first round, everybody directly votes for president. And if any one candidate gets more than 50% of the vote, then all you need is the first round, and that person's elected with a majority of the direct popular vote. However, as is usually the case, if no one candidate wins outright in the first round, then, you know, several weeks later, you have a second round in which only the top two vote-getters from the first round go through. So unless there's a tie, which is really which was very unlikely in a country of 330 million people, somebody is going to win, and that person will have a majority, and no one will ever be able to complain that that person was not legitimately elected president of the United States.
Good.
So, and that's just one way to do it, but I think that would be the very best way to institute a popular vote for Jeff, the president.
I would just say one of the things that hasn't come up yet that I think is really interesting is that when the Electoral College was created, the Constitution left it up to each individual state to figure out how their electors would be chosen. And so some states, the state legislature simply just said, these are going to be our electors. Other states said, we're just going to throw it out to a popular vote where every voter gets to vote. If we have 10 electors, every voter gets to write in 10 names. Some states broke it up and said, no, each district gets to vote for an elector, and then we get to have a statewide vote. Or some states said, we'll have congressional district will get to vote for an elector, and then the state legislature will appoint the other two. And it was really interesting. It's really interesting if you go back and look, seeing how many different methods were used, and then also seeing the degree to which a state would change its method of selecting electors based upon which party was in control of the legislature and which they thought would benefit. So they're manipulating the system to try and create better partisan outcomes. But I think it gets to this idea that the founders didn't know what they wanted it to be, even. They didn't have in mind, we need to have the Electoral College function in a very specific way to accomplish a very specific end. They just knew, we can't have it be this thing or the other things. So let's have an Electoral College, but then we'll leave it up to the states to figure out how that's actually going to work.
Now, obviously, I was going to say, the popular vote would be the one thing for us to get to. Jamie's already thrown an alternative on the table. Rank order voting would be another one that gets thrown on the table. How else can we get there?
We could do that. States could decide to do that tomorrow, and that's the other thing that because of the political concerns that Jeff is raising, the Electoral College is not going to be undone. I mean, there's no way that you have 75% of the states agree to that when they have so much relative power. Some of the small states, in particular, you can make some of these more incremental decisions. So states can decide. I mean, Louisiana does it. They don't do it for presidential elections, but they do it for every other election due to the French system, not surprisingly, being Louisiana. Like I said, we could increase the size of the House of Representatives. Just the House itself can do that by resolution. And then you would have a more reflective. And it might bring some of the problems Jeff raises, but it's certainly the problem right now. I don't know how it can get worse than what we have is that... very close you come to five times now, if you count what some scholars say 1960 was actually a Richard Nixon victory. Because of the choice of the electors was all over the place in Alabama, that actually Richard Nixon probably won Alabama and therefore got more votes and won. So as a consequence, I don't know how this can be worse, but there are plenty of ways states can directly kind of manage this and do this better to make it more reflective. And there are unintended consequences that come out of it, but there are intended consequences right now, as Jeff said, that come out of this that produce very perverse things. And 19 states have no connection between their popular vote outcome and their actual Electoral College slate. So in the 2000 election, for instance, part of the Bush-Gore decision, the Supreme Court said, well, Florida doesn't have it connected to your popular vote anyway, so the state legislature can just turn around and choose whoever they want. And they were already going to do it. So with or without Bush-Gore, it was going to be that outcome. So the consequence is that this is such a mess right now that needs discussion, needs plotting forward. But I don't know if the current system, in lieu of the fact that it's not going to be changed through the Constitution, doesn't need to be changed in many kind of ways that states can look into.
Well, let's quickly talk about some limitations of the direct popular vote. Jeff, do you have give us one issue with direct popular vote?
I'll point to the issue I pointed to before, and that's the majority principle. That if you have a strong third-party candidate running, you can end up with a president who, I mean, theoretically, you could have a president with 34% of the popular vote if it was really three strong parties running. Mm-hmm. And yeah, that person would win, but at that point, a third of the country said, we want this person to be a president, and suddenly that person is in charge. And I think that's a very legitimate concern to have.
Mm-hmm. Jamie?
I don't think there are any fundamental problems with a direct popular vote, except for that one, which can be fixed with the two-round majoritarian system, which is a direct popular vote. I mean, under democratic, under the way that the vast majority of human beings in the world today view democracy, which is a system in which everybody should be treated equally and everybody should have freedoms and everybody should have voice and all those things should be equal, I don't see, it's incredibly hard, I think, morally to argue against a direct popular vote, except when it produces some undesirable outcomes for, you know, as it would if it didn't have the second round built in.
Mike?
One technical issue is if we had a recount and we have 50 states and the District of Columbia deciding, and do Puerto Rico count the same? Does Guam count? I mean, who gets a vote that is constitutionally choosing the president or not? It's something we haven't thought about. If you want to go tell the Puerto Ricans suddenly they can't choose or don't have, I mean, when do we draw the line on who is eligible and who is not? And then, or do we leave it to the states and their definitions of who may vote and then have states run recount elections if it's a close election that states already struggle with? And the other argument that I don't know if I agree with is just the classic conservative argument that Daniel Patrick Moynihan said on the floor of the Senate when Evan Bayh's father, Birch Bayh, tried to change the Constitution along these lines in the 1970s. And he said, this would be the most drastic change to the U.S. Constitution ever. And we should be careful because of the unintended consequences that Jeff kind of talks about, is that they had something in mind. And we can debate whether or not how deeply held that was. But they were people that came out of the notions of the social contract and the notions of republicanism. And while they might not have thought about the mechanics in particular, they did think about the principles of republicanism. And there's plenty of countries around the world that don't have direct elections of who their leaders are. They are coalition-based governments, and people vote for a party, not an individual. And then later, the elites decide who's going to actually be the government, the execution executives of the government. There's no connection to what the electoral vote outcome was. And so it's not unlike other democracies entirely, right, Jamie?
On the surface, but the thing is parliamentary democracy is structured on very different principles with a very different set of priorities that stand as trade-offs when contrasted to presidential government. So I don't think it's quite fair to compare presidential government to parliamentary government on this score. If you choose parliamentary government, yes, you sacrifice direct election, but you gain a number of things that presidential democracy does not give you. If you choose presidential democracy, presumably the people are choosing the leader. And if it's not done directly, I think it's violating the principles in our modern understanding of democracy of presidential government.
Jeff?
So technically, I would agree, but fundamentally, I think it's not the same.
Earlier, you encouraged me to give people a historical tidbit of information, and I don't want people to leave here today without learning about my favorite proposed amendment to fix the Electoral College. 1808, Senator from Connecticut proposes eliminating the Electoral College entirely, not going to a popular vote, but instead changing the way the Senate is chosen. So senators would serve 3-year terms. Every year, 1/3 of the senators would be required to retire from the Senate. Yeah. And then you'd literally just put each senator's name on a ball, who's retiring. You'd put each senator's name on a ball. You'd put the balls in a bowl, and you'd pick a ball out of the bowl, and whoever's name got picked out of the bowl would be the president for the next year.
That's the one we need to try. That's the one we need to try right there. If you would very quickly give a round of applause to Jeff Milans from the Department of History, James Toole, the Department of Political Science, Mike Wolf from the Department of Political Science. We would like to open up the floor to questions from the audience. I do have a microphone that I will hand you if you have a question. Who has the first question for us?
Is this working? Okay. So with the Founding Fathers, I feel like what I'm hearing is like there was a spirit of kind of, we need to try this and see if it works. And as the country grows, we need to redevelop it and try new things. And I think the sense I'm getting from like our nation is that we get afraid. Like there's kind of this fear where it's like, oh, we can't try anything because we're afraid of what's going to happen. So my question is that fear warranted? Is America kind of too like big and too boisterous to try new things like that? Or do you think we can try these things while staying intact at the seams?
I mean, what's interesting is that coming out of the Constitutional Convention, most of the framers believed that the Constitution would undergo significant revision through an amendment process, that they'd give it a try for a few years, a variety of unforeseen problems would present themselves, and they'd have to change them. And ultimately, that didn't happen. I mean, they passed the Bill of Rights, and then they passed two amendments before the Civil War, and then they passed some amendments after the Civil War to address the massive change that came as a result of the Civil War. But they didn't ever really go through a process of saying, oh, this thing they'd written didn't work the way it was supposed to, let's make some changes. They either changed things informally or just worked within the system that was created. And at a certain point along the way, it turned into, oh my goodness, the founders were so wise, they anticipated every problem, and they designed a perfect system, and we can't make changes because this is what the founders wanted, and they knew what they were doing. And so to a certain extent, I think part of it is just this reverence for the founders and what they did leads us to believe we don't have the ability to make changes, which is just silly because they wanted us to make changes if we saw the need for them. I think some of the fear for the unintended consequences can be warranted depending on how far afield you're looking to go and the changes you're trying to propose. But at the same time, as a country, we are far from perfect. We make terrible mistakes all the time within the system we have. If we think that a change to a popular vote would produce legitimate positive change in the right direction, I think we have to be willing to overcome those fears.
By the way, I should mention that Jeff, and I can't remember who else was with us, but we had a conversation once before about Article 5 Constitutional Convention. There are some people who've been calling for that. It's not gone anywhere because of all the fear surrounding what would happen if we started down that road. Jamie?
Yeah, I would say there is... It is perfectly possible, and this is the position I take, to be incredibly impressed by our founders, whom I think did an amazing job, and also believe that after 200 years, there is nothing at all wrong with making some changes. When I look at the founders, what I see are a group of really passionate, intelligent people who are trying to figure out something without being able to see into the future, and were creating things that had never been created before. And I'm in awe of what they were trying to do and their actual accomplishments. But the idea that 200 years later, we should be trying to preserve everything they did and assume that they never wanted any changes is not helpful. But, and more than that, I would say, bringing us into the present day, there's an amazing work by a political scientist named Francis Fukuyama, who's written a magisterial two-volume study of the history of the state throughout all of human history. And he comes to the end, and one of his main points is that countries that find themselves unable to adapt their political institutions to changing times find themselves in increasing crisis. And the United States is a prime example that he gives. And he is an American. He's, you know, very loyal to the country. But he's saying that the gridlock that we have, the political polarization we have that is not resolved by our current structure of political institutions, is becoming increasingly dangerous. This is a very, very big problem that we need to start talking about.
And on the other side, there are the people that defend the system. Their arguments are that we'll end up with a populist that will destroy the two-party system, that will destroy federalism, and that you just don't go tinkering with the Constitution in the same way Moynihan was saying, that there are downsides to this. And where would you get change? I mean, the propulsion for change would need to come from politicians with guts, and I think the debates in the 1970s in the Senate showed that, or from outsiders like political scientists or something like that. But we tend to be a pretty conservative lot when it comes to suggesting changes to the American political system. We really are, and the party system. We're very loyal to American political parties, even with all their perversities. So I don't know where the angle comes from, except for the losing side. And the losing side right now is losing because it doesn't have the advantage it needs in the Electoral College system. And so it's hard to find the avenue to get to making a big change.
James? I'm sorry, just one very quick thing. I've been speaking very passionately about changing the Electoral College, and I just spoke passionately about being willing to reform institutions, but I completely agree with Mike. We do want to be careful about this. My point is that in over 200 years, we have barely changed our system at all. So there's been such incredibly minimal change. All I'm calling for is discussion over some carefully thought out, relatively minor changes that seem to me long overdue.
No, I agree, because you're talking about a real perversity of one person, one vote. that is getting worse by the decade, and it's not getting better, and that's not okay. So,
another question from anyone? Come here first.
Dr. Toole, I think you said it was repulsive that we don't directly elect the president, but couldn't that argument be extrapolated to all representative government? Like, we all elect representatives to act on our behalf. Like, I elected Todd Young to repeal the ACA. I didn't vote on that myself. So aren't electors that same sort of idea that we elect people to represent us and act on our behalf?
Yes, and that's an excellent point, but we do that by necessity. We have representatives acting on our behalf by necessity because we as a country of 330 million people cannot be actively engaged in direct democracy deciding every single aspect of government. So we have no choice but to have people represent us. And so that, I think, is a good thing because that's the only way we could possibly govern ourselves. So then I ask myself, how should we elect them? And if there is any way possible to directly elect them without interference, I think that's the way to go. And if it's perfectly possible to elect them without any interference, without any intermediation, without anyone else helping us along the way. So it's an excellent question. But for me, it comes down to what's necessary. We need to have elected representatives, but we certainly do not need to have an indirect method of voting for elected representatives.
Jeff. Also, Ed, you just kind of answered your own question there. You elected this specific person to do this specific thing. Who was the presidential elector, or who were the group of electors you voted? You don't know. You just know that you voted for one of the candidates, third-party candidate, and you had no control over how that person actually ended up voting or what they ended up doing. And so it'd be one thing if we did go back to, all right, I'm voting for Jamie to be my presidential elector and not Mike because I trust Jamie's judgment, but that's not the system we have.
Yeah, no, I like that. That's a good example.
One other point with the electors and the slate of electors, states choose them in multiple different ways. But the funny thing, you think this is a big august thing for, the Electoral College to meet or the slate to meet in state capitals. There's been examples. There's a great example in this book of them. One elector just didn't show up in Michigan one time. And so they're just given a tour of the state capitol, and they just had to grab this guy and say, hey, will you be elector today? If we connected it more formally, yes, to be sure. But instead this guy just gets pulled in and he's an elector. What if he was a faithless elector? That would have been... interesting. Anyway, sorry.
Actually, Mike was just wishing it was him. That's what it was. It was Michigan. It's his state. Go ahead.
You mentioned a two-tier voting system for president, but couldn't that be accomplished through the primary? If all primaries were open to 100% of voters, and is the topic we're talking about so much about the Electoral College and not versus the quality of candidates?
By two-tier, did you mean the two-round majoritarian system?
Yeah, essentially right. You do that through the primary.
Right. I see what you're saying, but again, using primaries as we do doesn't produce a guaranteed majority in the general election, whereas a two-round general election will produce a majority if you only allow the top two vote-getters from the first round to run in the second round. With only two candidates, one's going to have a majority built in.
And this is actually getting to a question about the way we run the elections. An actual open primary, which we clearly don't have here. Well, we don't have in Indiana. It functions that way, but by law we don't have it. That brings into question, what's the purpose of the primary? And if the purpose of the primary is truly to nominate the person from that ideology, from that party, who should represent them, then it shouldn't be an open primary. And so that gets to some very interesting questions about how to even run elections or what the purpose of a primary is.
Okay, so you kind of respond to this a little bit, but what I want to know is, compared to many other modern democracies, we have such a dismal voting rate in this country. Why do you think that is, and what do you think some potential fixes could be? Now, I know, Dr. Wolf, when I took your comparative political behavior, we studied that a little bit, making it voting day on a Tuesday national holiday, or many other democracies have it like on a Saturday or Sunday. Was potential things. I remember when I was in your class, what do you think could be done?
Well, those things, the design of the system was from the 1840s, and it was meant to be a voter turnout machine in an agricultural society to have a Tuesday vote away from the weekend where the churchgoers could show up. Not the first Tuesday, because if it's the November 1st, the Catholics won't show up to vote because it's a holy day of obligation. So this was an attempt. We just haven't updated it. And this is not in the Constitution. We can just change this. So this is a fixable thing. And some states, you know, move it around, like you said, Louisiana. So these are fixable things. The other thing is Americans do a lot of electing, and our voter turnout is relatively low for some elections and others. But we elect so many offices, and we demand so much of the American voter to turn out to vote, that, in fact, we do more electing than anyone else in the world. And we were just talking about this class today. The only people that are as low as us are the Swiss. And we in the Swiss, we're voting all the time for up and down, this and that. And so the argument is pound for pound, we end up doing more electing. So I'm not sure, you know, this would, we know that at the margins, voter turnout would be affected if we had a national election, because there it's a disincentive for some places. But I don't know if we have as much of a problem with voter turnout as we think we do.
I would just quickly add, I think the two-party system, and Mike might disagree with me on this, but I think the two-party system is a disincentive for a lot of people. That if you live, I mean, if you live in Indiana, Indiana's going to go red 9 out of 10 times or more. If you live in Massachusetts, maybe that's not the best example these days given the frequency with which they elect weird Republicans. But if you lived in Massachusetts, Massachusetts was going to go blue. So if you were a Democrat who felt pretty confident about that outcome, why would you show up? Or if you were a Republican who felt pretty confident that your vote wasn't going to matter, why would you show up? And so I think that becomes, in a lot of states, that becomes a real disincentive for participation.
We'll take one more question.
Coming from a place of ignorance and curiosity, I'd just be interested in hearing how it would be possible for a third-party candidate to be elected using our current Electoral College system.
Other than a whole lot of luck.
Yeah.
I mean, all right, so political scientists have looked long and hard at this for many decades, and I would say this is one of the strongest findings in all of political science, and that is that a very specific type of electoral procedure that we have here very, very strongly leans toward a two-party system. So if we were to change that, then it would open up the field for more parties. And that's the idea that we use a first-past-the-post system, one in which whoever gets the most votes wins. And a lot of Americans assume, just by our experience, that that's the only reasonable way to run elections. In fact, there are many, many different ways, many, many different sort of methods devised to figure out fundamentally how do you translate people's votes into deciding what people actually sit in what offices in the end. And I think, I don't know, if Mike, you have an easy way to explain why that logic produces just two parties, it can get kind of complicated. But essentially, that's it. And that's much more powerful than other things that people frequently say are problems for third parties, such as state signature requirements. I mean, those can be impediments, but most fundamentally is the fact that we use a certain type of voting. And we see around the world that countries that use that type of voting have fewer parties, and countries that use other type of voting tend to have more parties.
And we have a narrower gauge of ideological conflict, too, in the United States.
That too.
We didn't have a socialist movement, so the parties of the left have never been as regularized as they are in the European context, the Social Democrats and Labor parties. And even the conservative parties there are kind of even more open to government involvement in society than our parties are. So our narrow gauge of competition, even though it doesn't seem like it these days because of polarization, the room for a third party, while it's probably there to compete at and some offices were some of these incremental things there, the fact that on top of that you have this electoral system that makes somebody who might really want to have voted for Jill Stein or something say, do I want to vote for my favorite person or vote against my least favorite? You know, so their judgment gets thrown in there because of the mechanics of this.
One way to look at a simpler way to look at this is to consider our House races, right? We have 435 House districts. And let's say that there's a party in the United States, and sometimes there is, that, you know, could attract maybe 10 or 15% of the popular vote. What's the chances that in any one of those 435 House districts, that party is going to be strong enough even to win one seat. So we end up getting a House of Representatives in which that party has zero seats, but 10% support throughout the whole country. And that's in large part because of the rules under which we hold the election. In other words, whoever gets the most votes wins. So that party might win 27, 28, 30% of the vote in a particular district, but all it takes is the Democrats or Republicans to win 35% of the vote. And even in that district where that small party is unusually strong, it gets nothing. And so in the end, because we have essentially a winner-take-all system in which just that one person who gets the most votes wins, we have parties that can become considerable in their minority support around the country who don't win a single seat in the House. And so if your party's not at all competitive in the House, it's going to be harder for you to run candidates for president. It's going to be harder for you to run candidates for Senate, et cetera.
I want to thank everybody for coming to this discussion of the Electoral College. Please give the panelists a round of applause again. And also, please thank the Honor Center for allowing us to be in here, College Television for recording it, making it available, as well as WBOI and the Helm Key Library. Thank you all very much for joining us.